This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Well, good morning, everyone, and welcome to Pediatric Grand Rounds. My name is Ved Londe. I'm a neonatologist here in the Division of Neonatology. And it's my great pleasure this morning to welcome you all, and to welcome our guests from all of you from Santa Monica as well as Cedars. Good morning to everyone there. And it's with great pleasure that I introduce Dr. Brian Hackett. He is professor of pediatrics in the Division of Newborn Medicine at Washington University in St. Louis. And Dr. Hackett did his undergraduate training at Middlebury College, followed by a PhD at Boston College and an MD at St. Louis University School of Medicine. He then pursued his internship, residency, and fellowship at St. Louis Children's Hospital of the Washington University School of Medicine. And he has remained on as faculty at WashU and has risen through the ranks to a professor of pediatrics since 2011. He is also the director of the Neonatal Perinatal Medicine Fellowship Program at WashU in the Division of Newborn Medicine, and it is in that capacity that we actually invited him here to UCLA. He has come as a visiting guest and an external reviewer for our fellowship program here at UCLA. He's also the director of the Office of Faculty Development in the Department of Pediatrics at WashU, which is actually a very innovative new enterprise that is specifically designed to help faculty through all levels of their career. And we heard a little bit about this last year when Dr. Alan Schwartz, the chair from WashU, was visiting, and we were excited to learn more about that program. Dr. Hackett has been funded by the NIH for his studies in basic science in pulmonary development, and he is the author of more than 15 basic science publications. And this morning, we will hear about the topic of cilia, situs, and cysts. Please welcome Dr. Brian Hackett.
Well, thank you, Ved, and also thank you to Uday and Ved for inviting me to review the fellowship program in neonatology here. And I really enjoyed meeting with the fellows and the faculty in the division. They have a remarkable program in neonatology training here. And thanks again for the invitation to come visit. So this morning I want to talk to you about something that I've been interested in since I was actually a fellow in newborn medicine, and that is lung development. And I'm going to focus on a particular aspect of lung physiology. And then sort of how sort of those studies, which we started with the lung, and other groups have now looked in other organ systems and have found that this organ, the cilia, an organelle that I think for a long time was thought to really just be important for cell motility, really is important in a lot of cellular functions and has now been shown to be dysfunctions of cilia have been shown to be involved in a large number of human disease processes, and we'll talk about some of those today. First, as usual, I have no financial disclosures. And the goals and objectives of this Grand Rounds will be to try to gain some understanding of the various roles that cilia play in normal cellular function, to get some understanding of the genetics and mechanisms of cilia assembly, and then also to try to understand how cilia dysfunction can result in human disease. Two ACGME general competencies that this talk will address are patient care and medical knowledge. And if you're nice asking questions, we can also say it addresses professionalism at the end. So I'm going to start off with a case. And case one is a female that was born at 39 weeks gestation. Mom was 32 years old. Birth weight was over a little over 3,000 grams. Pregnancy was pretty much unremarkable. The mother was positive for group B strep and did get penicillin. It was a vaginal delivery. Apgar scores were 7 at 1 minute and 8 at 5 minutes. The infant was admitted to the nursery. And then was noted to have respiratory distress during the first few hours of life, was started on CPAP, and then transferred to St. Louis Children's Hospital. On examination was a term, female newborn with mild respiratory distress on CPAP. No dysmorphic features were present. The infant was noted to have some nasal secretions and had a normal heart exam, except the PMI was shifted to the right on exam. There were signs of respiratory distress, including tachypnea, some mild intercostal and subcostal retractions, no grunting or nasal flaring, and the remainder of the infant's exam was pretty much unremarkable. The initial chest X-ray that was obtained on admission showed that there was dextrocardia, so the heart was pointing towards the right. The stomach was noted to be in the left upper right quadrant, and the liver in the upper left quadrant. A 2D echocardiogram was done because of the concern of possible cardiac disease. This confirmed the dextrocardia, but was otherwise normal except for a left-to-right atrial level shunt. Abdominal ultrasound confirmed that the liver was in the upper left quadrant, spleen was in the upper right quadrant, stomach in the upper right, and the kidney and liver appeared normal. An upper GI was also obtained, which showed no evidence of malrotation. The infant was treated with intravenous antibiotics for 7 days. Blood cultures were negative. Over the first few days of life, the infant was initially weaned to room air. Because of the concern of possible primary ciliary dyskinesia with respiratory distress and the situs abnormalities, a nasal brush biopsy was obtained for electron microscopy. And then this did show an abnormal axonemal structure. The outer dyneen arms, which should be present out here, were absent on this infant's axonemes. At about 10 days of life, the infant was feeding well and had been weaned to room air, so was discharged to home. So this is one of the first diseases that was described many years ago, and I'll talk about this in more detail in a minute, primary ciliary dyskinesia, which is also sometimes goes by the term immotile cilia syndrome, or sometimes has been referred to as Carter-Gaynor syndrome, was the diagnosis in this infant with neonatal respiratory distress. So cilia have really been observed for a long time. So the Dutch microscopists in the 17th century had actually described cilia at that time. So Anton de Heide was the first one to describe cilia in mussels back in 1683, and von Leeuwenhoek was able to actually note the ciliary movement when he looked at them under the microscope, and he described these rotifers, these freshwater rotifers, Philodina roseola, as having diverse, incredibly thin feet or little legs, which were moved very nimbly. So he actually described the movement of cilia back in the 17th century. In the 18th century, O.F. Mueller coined the term cilia from the Latin word cilia or cilium, which means eyelid or eyelash in Latin. In the 1950s and 60s, investigators began to understand the structure of cilia. So Irene Manton and Bjorn Afzelius used electron microscopy to describe the structure. And the structure is shown over here. There's an axonemal structure, which is the portion of the cilia that projects above the cell surface. Within this, if you do a cross-section of the axoneme, they generally are a central pair of microtubules. And these are surrounded by 9 doublet pairs of microtubules. And there are a variety of other proteins associated with these. So there's these outer dyneen arms, which connect the microtubules to each other. There are also inner dyneen arms, which are also connected microtubules. And then there are a variety of radial structures that seem to hold the whole axonemal structure together. At the apex of the cell, the axoneme is anchored to the cell apex through a basal body, which is shown here. And the basal body is also constructed with microtubules. And these are triplet groupings of microtubules. So there's 9 triplets of microtubules forming the basal body. As many of you know, that the cilia move by these motor proteins, these dyneen motor proteins, which hydrolyze ATP and cause movement along the microtubules, which causes the cilia to bend. Further studies in the 60s and 70s isolated more of the proteins involved in cilia formation. The dyneen proteins and the tubulins were isolated. And by the early 2000s, over 200 proteins had been identified by proteomic analysis within the axoneme itself. And there's now been a large ciliary proteome described. And there's over 1,000 proteins, or up to about 1,000 proteins, that are required either for the assembly of cilia or for the actual structure of the cilia itself. So the assembly and structure of cilia are very complex. And so it's not surprising that there's a lot of things that can go wrong during cilia formation, and there's a lot of opportunities for having dysfunctional cilia with mutations in any one of these multiple proteins that are required. So Initially, really, people thought of cilia as primarily motile organelles, that they were needed for cell, for movement of fluids across cell surfaces, or for the movement of things like sperm. So the flagella on a sperm is basically a cilium. As people have begun to understand that there are multiple types of cilia, they seem to fall into two basic categories that can be described either by their ability to move. So there are some cilia that are involved in movement and are motile, and there are other cilia that are seem to be involved in signaling that are non-motile cilia. These also can be described, divided by their ultrastructure. So some of these have nine outer microtubule doublets with a pair of central microtubules, and others are absent the central microtubule pair. The types that are involved in motility and movement are the 9 plus 2, and the ones that we probably generally think of, like airway epithelial cilia, there are cilia in the brain ependema, the fallopian tube has cilia, and also the flagellum of a sperm is this type of cilia as well. There are also motile cilia in the embryonic node, and we'll talk about those in a little bit more detail later on, but these have a little bit different structure. These are 9 plus 0, so there's no central pair of microtubules. There are also a large variety of cilia that appear to be involved in signaling. These tend to be, these are non-motile. Most of these have the 9 plus 0 structure, and they're found in places like the renal tubule, the bile duct, pancreatic ducts, osteocytes, chondrocytes, photoreceptors, and our olfactory receptors all have cilia. And it's thought that actually cilia are probably present on nearly every vertebrate cell, these signaling types of cells, and play very important roles, and we'll talk about that a little later on in cell signaling. So I'm going to go over cilia assembly just to give you some sense of how complex formation of a cilia is. And there's essentially four steps. One is the generation of the basal bodies, migration of the basal bodies, and anchoring of the basal bodies, and then elongation of the axoneme. And because the proteins and the assembly processes in cilia are so well conserved evolutionarily, much of our understanding of how cilia are assembled and what genes and proteins are important have come from the studying other organisms, model organisms. And one of the primary ones has been this Chlamydomonas, which is an algae that has two flagella. And the sort of the same proteins and the same processes that are required for assembling cilia in Chlamydomonas, or the flagella in Chlamydomonas, are pretty much the same ones that are required in assembly of human cilia as well. So there's basically two mechanisms that basal bodies are generated by. One of these is dependent on the centriole. So the centriole serves as an organizing center, and there's duplication of the centriole. And the centriole can form hundreds of basal bodies, which will then go on to eventually anchor hundreds of cilia. There's another process, which is a deuterosome-dependent. And in the deuterosome-dependent, there's no centriole involved, but there is a microtubule organizing center, and basal bodies will form around this microtubule organizing center, and these basal bodies will then also go on and migrate to the apical region of the cell. Both of these processes can occur within the same cell, so some cells will have both the centriolar-dependent as well as a deuterosome-dependent mechanisms of basal body generation. And then, as I said, these will eventually migrate. They're formed in the cytoplasm, and they migrate to the apical region of the cell, where they can anchor to the apical cytoskeleton. The anchoring of the basal bodies to the cytoskeleton, in some studies that were done in my lab, and many of you, I'm sure, know Bridget Gompertz, who, when she was a fellow in hematology oncology at Washington University, had worked in my lab, and these are studies that Bridget did. And she showed that these two proteins, Ezrin and EBP50, which anchor a lot of different proteins to the apical cytoskeleton, are probably also involved in anchoring the basal bodies to the cytoskeleton as well. And so this is a immunofluorescence using a red fluorescent dye for Ezrin and a green marker for ciliated cells. And you can see that the Ezrin co-localizes with the ciliated cells along the pulmonary epithelium. And when we did immunogold electron microscopy, and this was again for using an antibody to Ezrin, and you can see that Ezrin associates with the basal bodies throughout the apical region of the cell. And the same for this second protein, EBP50, again using immunofluorescence, there's co-localization of the EBP50 with the ciliary structure. So our conclusion was that both Ezrin and EBP50 were required for anchoring the basal bodies to the cytoskeleton. Others have since shown that there's a lot of other proteins that are probably involved in this process as well. So I want to take a little intermission here now and talk about St. Louis to you, because I'm sure many of you are not familiar with St. Louis, and I want to just brag about St. Louis and some of the things we have to offer. First, I want to tell you about one of our main attractions is our baseball team, the St. Louis Cardinals. They've won 11 world championships. This photograph happens to be taken from a game last year. I think it was the last game of the National League Championship Series when they defeated the Well, we'll just go ahead. We also have some great food in St. Louis. One of the specialties in St. Louis is the fried brain sandwich, and this is a real a food item in St. Louis. And I think they're generally pork brains. I've not actually ever tried a fried brain sandwich. I think the price has gone up from when this picture was taken, though, 25 cents. And if you really don't want the fried brain sandwich, there's always the old fallback of donuts in St. Louis as well. And the last attraction that probably most of you are aware of is the St. Louis Arch. And the arch is actually a pretty magnificent monument. It's one of those things that when you first see it, you're actually impressed by it. People can't really overhype this. And this is a view of the of St. Louis downtown at night, looking from the Illinois side of the Mississippi River. This is the river here, if I can find this, in the front of the arch, and looking west towards the city. And I think if you look really carefully, you may be able to see Westwood there in the distance somewhere. So I'm going to use this sort of to come back to Celia now, because when the engineers, the arch was built in the early 1960s, and they faced the problem of how do they get these modules, so it was sort of built in a modular form. How did they get these things to the top of the arch? So the arch is over 600 feet tall. So they had, I think, a rather ingenious solution to this problem. What they did was they built basically railroad tracks up each leg of the arch. So this is a track that goes up the side of the arch, and there's one on the other leg of the arch. And they had these cranes that were specially designed to fit on these tracks. So as the arch got greater in height, these cranes could just move up this track, add more track, and add new sections to the arch until they got to the top. And Celia actually is a very similar process to build the axoneme. So there's a process called intraflagellar transport, or IFT it's called, that is the way that ciliated cells get the components of the axoneme further and further out as the axoneme grows in length. So the components, the proteins, are all synthesized in the cytoplasm, as you'd usually expect, and they get attached to these what are called IFT rafts. And these rafts include the proteins that sort of hold the whatever you're trying to transport in place, and they also have motor proteins associated with them. So these motor proteins can then use the microtubules that they're building as basically a track to crawl up the side of the cilia and add new microtubule sections to the growing axoneme. They can also carry, there's a variety of different receptors and things that localize the cilia. So this intraflagellar transport is also a way for the cilia to take receptors and other proteins that it wants to put on the membrane of the cilia and deposit those in the appropriate place. And there's also a retrograde transport where these proteins can be returned to the cytoplasm. And this is these are dynein motors. So the kinesins are the anterograde transport, and the retrograde transport are kinesins, are involved motor proteins. And this is a cell. This was a Xenopus skin cell, and these are multiciliated cells. And what they've done is they add some fluorescently labeled protein. This was a study done by another group. And they took a video of this, and if you watch the video, you'll be able to see these fluorescent particles moving out towards the tip of the cilia and also back in towards the cell itself. So I think as we checked this, and it did work. So you can see these fluorescently labeled products moving both towards the tip of the cilia, and then some of them are moving back. And this is how the cilia is able to transport things further and further out to the axonemal tip. So just like the arch, the axoneme will elongate, adding sections of it and using the intraflagellar transport to eventually get the full length cilia. So one of the first diseases that was thought to be due to cilia was described by Carter Gaynor back in the 1930s. And he described four patients who had a triad that consisted of situs inversus, bronchiectasis, and sinusitis. And this became known as Carter Gaynor syndrome eventually. In 1962, he had amassed 334 cases of this syndrome. And he recognized that some of these, so the initial definition of Carter Gaynor syndrome was you had to have all three things, situs inversus, bronchiectasis, and sinusitis. But as he amassed more cases, he realized that some of these cases ran in the families, and that some of these familial cases that had the bronchiectasis and sinusitis but did not have situs inversus. So there were two groups of patients with Carter Gaynor's, those with situs inversus and those without situs inversus. In the 1970s, Bjorn Afzelius, who did some of the original work on describing the ultrastructure of the cilia, began to look at some of these patients with Carter-Gaynor syndrome, and he identified defects in the cilia ultrastructure. And these ultrastructural defects were associated with abnormal ciliary motility, and at that time the name the syndrome was called immotocilia syndrome or primary ciliary dyskinesia. And he proposed back in the 1970s actually that situs inversus that was seen in these patients was probably due to abnormalities in embryonic cilia. And no one at that time actually knew, and I'll show you a little bit later on, that embryos actually have cilia that are probably very important in determining, or are important in determining, left-right axis asymmetry during development. So primary ciliary dyskinesia occurs in about 1 in 10,000 or 1 to 20,000 births. Many of its features are pulmonary, so there's disruption of normal mucociliary clearance because you've lost normal ciliary movement. It's actually frequently presents with respiratory distress in the newborn period. So about 80% of full-term infants who have primary ciliary dyskinesia will have newborn respiratory distress, just like the baby I described at the beginning of Grand Rounds. And oftentimes this goes unrecognized as ciliary dyskinesia, unless, you know, it does tip it off a little bit if there's also situs inversus involved. As older children will have chronic rhinitis, wet cough, otitis media, and frequent sinusitis. They're prone to recurrent bacterial infections of the lower airways. With increasing age, bronchiectasis becomes more of a problem. So 50 to 75% of older children will develop bronchiectasis. In adults, that gets to be 100%. Chest imaging will show things, pretty nonspecific findings, atelectasis, air trapping, mucus plugging, and thickened airway walls. These patients will develop abnormal lung function over time, so they have a decreased FEV1 and also inhomogeneous ventilation. Oftentimes in childhood, the diagnosis is missed because a lot of these respiratory symptoms are pretty common in children, so runny nose, cough, things like that. And so they overlap with other more common childhood illnesses. And only about half, as I talk about, only about half patients with this disease will have the situs inversus. So the non-pulmonary clinical features, sinus inversus is obviously an important one. There are other laterality defects sometimes seen in this. So about 60% of pediatric patients will have situs abnormalities. And this is probably somewhat of an ascertainment bias because with a patient who has sort of recurrent respiratory problems and situs inversus, you're more likely to go ahead and try to make the diagnosis of primary ciliary dyskinesia. In the patients without the situs inversus abnormalities, the age of diagnosis is going to be older. So by the time you get to the adults, only about 50% of adults have situs inversus. So it's thought that determination of situs has been randomized in primary ciliary dyskinesia. So half the time you'll have normal situs and half the time you'll have abnormalities of situs. A small number of patients have other laterality defects, and we'll talk about some of those a little bit later on. Because the flagella in the sperm is required for fertility, almost 100% of males are infertile, and there's also decreased fertility in the females, probably due to the absence of cilia on the oviduct, and there is an increased risk of ectopic pregnancy. There are some other features that are a little less common, pectus excavatum and scoliosis. There also are some case reports of hydrocephalus in patients with primary ciliary dyskinesia, and there are cilia that line the ependymal layer of the brain, so it's probably related to dysfunction of those cilia. The median age of diagnosis is about 5 years old. Sometimes this will be based on clinical features, the recurrent infection, the wet cough, the rhinitis. But it's actually a little bit easier, obviously, if the patient has situs inversus. That should be a real big tip-off that this is a ciliary problem. Oftentimes, the patients who have this or are suspected of having this have to be referred to a specialized center for diagnosis because the techniques that are used to make the diagnosis are technically difficult, and you really need people who are experienced at interpreting the data. So it was thought for a long time that the gold standard was to identify ultrastructure defects by electron microscopy. This can be done with a nasal or bronchial biopsy. This is an axoneme, cross-section of a normal axoneme. You can see here the pairs of microtubules surrounding a central pair. And the important thing here to note is that these have both an outer dyneing arm and an inner dyneing arm. The most common ultrastructural abnormality is to have absent outer dyneing arms, as shown here. So this patient, this axoneme, if you look carefully, there are no outer axonemal arms, dyneing arms, but there are inner arms on this one. Some patients also have an absent inner dining arm, as shown here, and in some patients, both arms will be absent. And there's a whole variety of other ultrastructural defects that are seen, but these are by far the three most common. And it was thought for a long time that this was a gold standard, but it turns out about 30% of the patients, and I guess I blocked it with the picture there, actually have ultrastructurally normal axonemes, but have some other problem that result in dysmotility. Another way to make the diagnosis is by looking at ciliary motility. This can be, again, done with a nasal or bronchial biopsy. It requires high-speed video microscopy to do. And the problem with this is it can be affected if a patient has any inflammation or infection that affects ciliary motility, so it may be hard to interpret. And more recently, people have started looking at nasal nitric oxide. And for reasons that aren't really understood, patients with ciliary dyskinesia have a much reduced level of nasal nitric oxide, so it's only 10 to 20% of normal. And the problem with this is the sampling is very difficult because the lower airways have much lower levels of nitric oxide. So if the sample is contaminated at all with air from the lower airways, it's going to lower it. So it has to be a nasal sample only. It's obviously the patient has to be cooperative. So usually you can't do it in patients that are 5 years of age. And sometimes patients with cystic fibrosis or respiratory infections may also have decreases in their nasal nitric oxide. So you have to rule out those things as well. The genetics of this, it's a highly heterogeneic disease. As we talked about, there's hundreds of proteins that are required for assembly and the structure and function of cilia. Almost all cases have been autosomal recessive. There are some case reports of autosomal dominant X-linked inheritance. At this point, about 65% of the cases have a known disease-causing mutation, and these have been identified by a variety of strategies. Some of these are candidate genes that were initially identified in model organisms. So the first dynein that was gene that was identified as being mutated in human primary ciliary dyskinesia was actually one that had been identified in Chlamydia monas initially that had abnormal cilia or flagella. Homozygosity mapping has also been used. And now people have actually characterized the cilia transcriptome and proteome. So there's a lot of potential genes that are available. And people have also gone to whole exome sequencing to identify genetic mutations associated with ciliary dyskinesia. So this is a list of, this is from a review in 2013. I think there's 21 genes on this list that have been identified as being associated with ciliary dyskinesia or causing ciliary dyskinesia. The blow-up of this shows the genes that are responsible for the majority of cases. Most of these are these dynein genes, which are result in outer dynein arm defects. And these account for 15 to 21%, 2 to 9%, and 2% of all patients with primary ciliary dyskinesia. So the majority of them are due to these mutations in these dynein proteins. There's also another group of proteins that affect both the outer dynein arm and inner dynein arm, or mutations in these genes. And these are thought to be genes that are involved primarily in assembly of the cilia. So both the outer dynein arms and the inner dynein arms are affected in these patients. And it's a relatively small number of patients that have these particular mutations. A number of these also have laterality defects associated with them. So the ones I've circled all have laterality defects, so situs inversus. And there are some, however, where laterality defects or situs defects have not been identified. And it's not clear to me if that's just because the number of patients are so small that they haven't found the patients with situs or if they truly don't result in situs abnormalities. Since this review was written, actually, which was sometime in 2013, six new genes were identified that are associated or cause primary ciliary dyskinesia. So it's a very active area of research, and people continually are identifying new genes. In fact, after I made this slide, I was looking through the literature, and a seventh new gene had been described, this encoding cyclin O gene, which was just published online in Nature Genetics about 5 days ago. So there's really been an increase in the number of genes that have been identified as being causative in primary ciliary dyskinesia. So in terms of managing it, there are no specific therapies that have been identified. And most of the therapies that are used have been extrapolated from other chronic pulmonary diseases, particularly cystic fibrosis. There's very limited data on the efficacy of these treatments in patients with primary ciliary dyskinesia. Some of the things, frequent monitoring of these patients is recommended. I think for a long time people felt that patients with primary ciliary dyskinesia did pretty well and didn't have any lung dysfunction, but it turns out they really do have decrease in their lung function over time. So the recommendation is that pulmonary functioning tests and respiratory culture be done every 3 to 6 months, and that some type of chest imaging, including CT scan, be done on a routine basis. These patients usually get daily chest physiotherapy to help with mucociliary clearance. They are prone to disease exacerbations similar to patients with cystic fibrosis. So they do get antibiotic therapy, which is culture-directed. Sometimes they'll have chronic antibiotic therapy if they're colonized with Pseudomonas, although their colonization with Pseudomonas is less than you see in patients with cystic fibrosis. And some physicians have tried using inhaled gentamicin to reduce exacerbations. In some patients, surgical approaches are used. So lobectomy has been done in patients who have severe localized bronchiectasis and they failed medical treatment. And there are some patients who have required lung transplantation because of end-stage lung disease. I think one of my interests, and I'll get to sort of why I became interested, is how cilia are involved in the determination of situs or laterality in organisms. And if you look at, this is a drawing of looking down at an early embryo, a pre-gastrulation stage embryo, where the primitive streak is formed and the node is formed. And by electron microscopy of the node, if you look, there are cilia present within the node that are transiently there during development around the time of gastrulation. And these are motor cilia, but the position of these cilia is very important in determination of left-right axis asymmetry. So these cilia tend to be located in the posterior region of the cell, and they also have a posterior tilt to them. So when these cilia spin, and I'll show you a video later on of some of these cilia spinning, they create a flow that goes from the right side of the node to the left side of the node during embryonic development. People have argued, and there's two basic theories for how this flow in the node from right side to the left side is able to create asymmetry during embryonic development. Some people feel that there's these packets, which they call nodal vesicular packets, that are basically membrane-encased packages of morphogens that get moved from the right side of the node or an accumulator on the left side of the node, where they then release the morphogen, and those morphogens are detected by sensory cilia on the left side of the node. The other theory is that it's just the actual flow itself that causes transduction of a mechanical signal on the left side of the node by these cilia located over here that bend in response to the flow, and that creates a signal on the left side of the embryo as well. Whichever of these two mechanisms is involved, and it's, again, people haven't really decided which one is in fact the mechanism, there is an increase of calcium on the left side of the node in response to this flow. So this is looking at a node. This was work done by another group at Yale, and this is the embryonic node. And what they've done is they've loaded the cells with a dye that fluoresces in response to increased calcium. And you can see over here on the left edge of the node, this dye is increased in intensity, so there's an increase of intracellular calcium over on the left side of the node in response to this right-to-left flow. This calcium signal is then thought to result in an asymmetric pattern of expression of genes. There are a group of genes, and I won't go through the details of all these, that are expressed exclusively on the left side of the embryo, and there's another set of genes that are expressed exclusively on the right side of the embryo during early embryonic development. And since people are beginning to identify these genes, there are also also cases of situs abnormalities that are associated with mutations in a variety of these genes, as well as genes that are involved in ciliary motility. These left-right signals are then interpreted during development to create asymmetry during development. So, for example, things like the heart and the gastrointestinal system undergo this asymmetric bending and rotations to give you the asymmetric structures of the heart and the gastrointestinal tract. Organs like the lung and the liver, in response to these asymmetric signals, will undergo asymmetric branching, so you get the asymmetries that you see in the liver and the lung. And finally, in the cardiovascular system or the vascular system, there are also asymmetries that are created by loss of blood vessels on either the left or right side of the developing embryo, so you get these asymmetries of the vascular system during embryonic development in response to those asymmetric signals early in the embryo. So if everything goes okay, you end up with cytosolitis shown here, where all the organs are in the appropriate position with respect to the left-right body axis. Situs inversus, which is shown here, or situs inversus totalis, which is what most patients with primary ciliary dyskinesia have, is when the organs are completely reversed, so they're a complete mirror image of each other. And usually the organs are functional, they usually aren't problems because they're just reversed in their positioning. There are other cases which are of asymmetries or dysfunction or abnormal laterality, such as left isomerism, which is also referred to as polysplenia, where you essentially have two left sides to the body. There's right isomerism, where you essentially, or asplenia, where you have two right sides, so you don't have a spleen because the spleen is normally on the left. And then you can have a variety of other types of heterotaxia, sort of the general term for these malformations of situs. You can have where the thoracic situs is abnormal, but the abdominal situs is normal, or you can have the normal thoracic situs but abnormal abdominal situs. There's a large number of organ defects that are associated with heterotaxia or these defects in laterality, and I've listed them here. Usually the most concerning ones are there's a wide variety of congenital heart defects that are associated with laterality defects, and you know they range from anything from very simple ones to very complex and life-threatening ones that require cervical intervention. There are also pulmonary abnormalities, generally bilateral, bilobed, or bilateral trilobed lungs, bowel malrotation, a variety of extrahepatic biliary atresia, cystic dysplasia of the pancreas. As we talked about, there can be absent spleen, asplenia, or small spleens, polysplenia. There are also some central nervous system defects that have been associated with these laterality defects, as well as genital urinary defects. There are a number of syndromes that have been identified in which laterality is a major portion of that. The one we've been talking about primarily is ciliary dyskinesia, which has the situs inversus and the bronchiectasis and the respiratory problems. Cardiac malformations are generally uncommon in these in primary ciliary dyskinesia, but they do occur. There are, as I talked about, there's a variety of other genes that are involved in situs determination, and a lot of these genes are all have been identified as being mutated in these other forms of situs heterotaxia as well. Some of these are X-linked, some autosomal dominant, and some autosomal recessive. So I became interested in cilia, as I said, when very early on in my career. And I was working in a lab, and we were interested in identifying genes that were important in lung development. And we identified a gene which at the time was called HFH4, but has since been renamed FOXJ1 because it's in a large family of transcription factors. And FOXJ1 is a member of this forkhead box of transcription factors. And our initial studies show that it was expressed in ciliated cells, not only in the lungs. So these are all mouse tissues. So this is expression of FOXJ1 in a day 16 mouse lung, and it's expressed in the proximal pulmonary epithelium. But it was also expressed in the seminiferous tubules of the testes, also expressed in the oviduct, and also expressed in the central nervous system, the ependymal lining of the brain and spinal cord during embryonic development of the mouse. So its expression was associated with places where he knew that there were ciliated cells present. So we did a bunch of other things, but we did eventually do a knockout of FOXJ1, so we mutated it. And we got a very nice phenotype. And so this shows these are tissues from a wild-type mouse, and these are the knockout mice. And these mice are completely absent any ciliary structures. So in the bronchioles, there's no cilia lining the bronchiole, where you see them here in the normal mouse. If you look in the seminiferous tubule, you see all these flagella that extend down into the opening of the tubule, the lumen. And in the FOXJ1 mice, there are no flagella present. There are nuclei present. You can see these darker structures, which are the nuclei of spermatozoa, but the tails are missing. And also with the oviduct, or oviduct as we say in St. Louis, there's cilia normally present here, which are absent in the targeted mutation of the FOXJ1. The defect in cilia appears to be one that prevents anchoring of the basal bodies to the apical cytoskeleton. So again, this is a transmission electron microscope of a normal pulmonary epithelial cell from a mouse. You can see the basal bodies line up along the apical surface of this cell, and you can see the axonomal structures in the lumen of the airway. In the FOXJ1 knockout mice, the basal bodies are spread throughout the basal bodies are formed, but they're spread throughout the cytoplasm. They don't localize to the apical cytoskeleton, and no axonemal structures are present. present. And we looked at expression of Ezrin in the wild-type mouse, as I showed before. Ezrin co-localizes with ciliated cells, and we see no presence of Ezrin in the apex of the knockout FOXJ1 knockout mice. So a lot of other studies have been done by other groups, and in FOXJ1, along with another transcription factor, RFX, have been shown to be essential for regulating the expression of a large number of genes that are required for cilia formation. And these include genes that are required for dynein assembly and docking, structural genes that are involved in the axoneme, genes important for intraflagellar transport. And for almost all aspects of cilia assembly and cilia structure, these two genes, FOXJ1 and RFX, are crucial to forming cilia. And they also interact with each other, so there's this mutual interaction between FOXJ1 and RFX1. In this figure, the color coding means, not that it's probably that important, the red are genes that have been shown to be regulated by FOXJ1, the light blue are those that are regulated by RFX, and the ones that are purple are regulated by both transcription factors. So in addition to having the absence of cilia in these targeted mutations, we also noted that these mice had laterality defects. So here's a wild-type mouse, and you can see the stomach, which is filled with milk here, is in the normal position on the left side of the mouse. And in the FOXJ1 knockout mouse, the stomach is located on the right, so there's situs abnormalities. FOXJ1 is expressed in the node, shown here in this whole mount in situ hybridization, and also shown here in this staining with an antibody to FOXJ1. And these mice also have cardiac defects. So this shows a FOXJ1, a knockout mouse that has an AV canal defect shown here. So we became interested why knockout of FOXJ1 results in these laterality defects that we saw in the mice. And when we looked at the expression of genes that are expressed normally only on the left side of the mouse, or should be expressed only on the left side of the mouse embryo, those patterns of gene expression are disrupted. So PIDX1, which in the wild-type mouse is expressed only on the left, in the FOXJ1 mice, sometimes it's expressed on the right, sometimes expressed on both sides of the embryo. The same thing with LefT2, which normally should be expressed only on the left. This is whole mount staining, so the blue is where the gene is expressed. We saw no expression of LefT2 in these knockout mice. And NODL, which is another gene that's normally expressed only on the left side of the embryo, was expressed sometimes on both sides of the embryo, sometimes not expressed at all, and sometimes expressed only on the right. When we look by scanning electron microscopy, however, no cilia are still present in the node of these mice. And another group looked in more detail at these cilia that were present in the node in FOXJ1 knockout mice. And what they found out was the cilia, they looked at a number of mutants. This is the wild-type mouse, and this would be the FOXJ1 knockout mouse. These mice had cilia that were shorter in length than the wild-type, so this is the length of the wild-type mouse. The cilia is about 2.5 microns, and in the FOXJ1 knockout mice, they were less than 1 micron in length. And the positioning of these cilia on the embryonic node cells was also abnormal. So as I talked about earlier, the majority of these cilia are present in the posterior aspect of the nodal cells in the wild type, shown here in green. And in the FOXJ1 knockout mouse, only a small number of the cilia were in the correct position on the nodal cells. And they also did video microscopy. So this shows the movement of this nodal cilia in a normal mouse. So you can see they have this rotary movement that's going to create this right-to-left flow of fluid within the node. And when they looked in the FOXJ1 mouse by video microscopy, they see absolutely no movement of these nodal cilia in these FOXJ1 knockout mice. So they're immodal, and that's probably the reason that the appropriate signals for left-right differentiation are not seen in these mice. So I'm going to sort of change gears a little bit and talk about another case. This is another infant that was in our hospital. It was a baby born at 33 weeks gestation, about 2 kilograms birth weight. Mom was 24 years old, had unremarkable serologies. The pregnancy was complicated by oligohydramnios, and was also known to be enlarged kidneys by ultrasound and also preterm labor. Delivery was by cesarean section for breech presentation. Apgar scores were 3 and 6. The infant was intubated in the delivery room for respiratory distress and given surfactant and transferred to our neonatal intensive care unit. On examination, it was a preterm intubated male newborn. Was noted to have some facial features such as a flattened nasal bridge, a beaked nose, receding chin, and flattened external ears, which you probably will recognize as Potter's facies. Breath sounds were decreased bilaterally. There were diffuse crackles. And they were noted on examination to be bilateral flank masses as well as contractures of the extremities. An X-ray showed these abdominal enlargement with these bilateral flank masses. There were small lung volumes. There was a left pneumothorax and a small residual right pneumothorax. And on abdominal ultrasound, the kidneys were noted to be bilaterally enlarged with diffusely increased echogenicity as well. The infant had right and left thoracostomy tubes placed and remained hypoxic and hypercarbic despite maximum ventilatory support and then expired about 12 hours of life. On autopsy, the infant was found to have bilateral lung hypoplasia. The kidneys, as shown here, were enlarged bilaterally. If I can get this thing to work. Enlarged bilaterally, and also on microscopic examination of the kidney, there were noted to be these cysts within the collecting ducts. So this is an infant who had autosomal recessive polycystic kidney disease with associated Potter sequence and pulmonary hypoplasia. And at first glance, you might not think that this patient disease is related to the patients that the first patient I talked to with the primary ciliary dyskinesia. But it turns out that cilia are probably also important in transducing cell signals that may be involved in the development of renal cysts. So just to sort of review a little bit about autosomal recessive polycystic kidney disease, it may present antenatally with ultrasound that shows large echogenic kidneys and oligohydramnios. Postnatally, these infants often have massively enlarged kidneys, so there's bilateral palpable flank masses, the Potter's facies like the patient I presented, pulmonary hypoplasia, hypertension, and some infants will have hepatomegaly, but that's more commonly develops in childhood or young adult age. By ultrasound, the kidneys are large, echogenic, there's poor cortical medullary differentiation. Usually you don't see macrocysts with the autosomal recessive form of polycystic kidney disease, but there may be focal rosettes, which are these radially oriented collecting tubule ducts. Pathology is in the baby I presented, shows massively enlarged kidneys bilaterally. There are these microcysts within the collecting tubules that are about less than 4 millimeters in diameter. And oftentimes there's liver involvement, so you may have bile duct proliferation and hepatic fibrosis as well with this disease. This occurs at about 1 in 10,000 to 1 in 20,000 live births. It usually presents in the newborn period. There's about 23 to 30% mortality in the newborn period, almost exclusively due to pulmonary insufficiency. Of the infants that survive the first year of life, there's about an 82% survival, a 10-year survival for those infants. The renal problems are they can have oliguria or even polyuria, the hyponatremia, generally have evidence of decreased renal function with elevated creatinine and BUN. About half of the survivors will develop end-stage renal disease at some point. By 5 years of age, it's 14%, at 10 years, 29%, and then 58% at 20 years of age. They also have hepatic problems, so about 45% of newborns have evidence of hepatic disease. Usually in adults, the hepatomegaly will develop, and they can have a variety of complications, including ascending cholangitis, liver dysfunction or failure, portal hypertension, and about 70% of survivors will eventually develop portal hypertension. The main cause of death in the neonatal period is associated pulmonary hypoplasia. Originally, it was thought this was probably secondary to the oligohydramnios, but I think there's some thought that maybe this is not a sort of indirect cause of oligohydramnios, but may in fact be related to a primary defect in pulmonary development associated with whatever the causative mutation is. Other things would be Potter's facies, and some of these infants or patients with autosomal recessive forms of polycystic kidney disease will develop cerebral aneurysms, but those are more common in the autosomal dominant form of polycystic kidney disease. Management, the initial period is stabilization of respiratory function, so many of these children will need infants will need respiratory ventilation. Some people have tried nephrectomy, so if the kidneys are so massively enlarged that you get restriction of the thoracic excursion or the diaphragmatic excursion, people will try removing the kidneys to give more room for ventilation. Renal problems, of course, fluid and electrolyte management. Some of these infants will require peritoneal dialysis for oliguria or anuria. Hypertension can develop early on and is treated with angiotensin-converting enzymes or angiotensin II receptor inhibitors, and then for end-stage renal disease, dialysis, and many of these patients will go on to require, or some will require a renal transplantation eventually. Hepatic disease, management of the portal hypertension, treatment of ascending cholangitis and sepsis with antibiotics, nutritional support becomes very important, and eventually some of these patients will go on to require liver transplantation. And one of the big questions with these patients is if you're doing a renal transplantation, should you also go ahead at that same time and do liver transplantation? And there are various algorithms to help people decide if they should do just a single organ transplant or both transplant. The gene that's mutated in autosomal recessive polycystic kidney disease has been identified. It's this PKHD1 gene. It's a big gene. It has 67 exons and over almost 500,000 base pairs. It has a 12,000 base pair open reading frame. There are multiple alternatively spliced products, and it's expressed in various adult and fetal organs, including the kidney, liver, pancreas, and lung. Well, that's the protein. The most common pattern of disease-causing mutations is the compound heterozygote in these patients with autosomal recessive disease. So up to three-quarters of the patient, there's two different mutations in the PKHD1 gene. In about 18 to 39% of the patients, they're homozygous, so there's only one mutation identified. In about up to 8% of the patients, no mutations have been identified yet. So in about 92% of the patients, the disease-causing mutation is known. The protein product of the PKHD1 gene is fibrocystin, which is also sometimes called polyductin. It does localize to the primary cilia of the renal kidney cells, so it's associated with two other proteins, polycystin 1 and polycystin 2. It's a large protein, over 4,000 amino acids. Most of it is shown here is extracellular. It has and this is the intracellular portion, just a small intracellular tail with a transmembrane domain. It does have a variety of functional domains, these TIG and TIG-like domains shown here, and these are thought to serve a receptor function, and there's also this TMEM domain shown here, and the function of that is not known. Autosomal recessive polycystic kidney disease, as the name implies, is recessively inherited. There's 100% penetrance of the disease, but there is a great deal of intrafamilial variability in the phenotype itself. So autosomal recessive polycystic kidney disease is one of a large number of cystic kidney diseases that have now been identified, including autosomal dominant polycystic kidney disease, nephronophthisis, Joubert syndrome, Bardet-Biedl syndrome, Meckel-Gruber syndrome, oral facial digital syndrome, short rib polydactyly, and eumodulin associated kidney disease. And these have a variety of features in addition to the cysts that are seen in the kidney. But the important thing probably about this is that all of the proteins that have been identified associated with these diseases are proteins that are associated with cilia. So some of these are with the axoneme, some of these are associated with the basal body, or some of these may be involved in intraflagellar transport, but all of them are in some way associated with formation of cilia in cells. And the cilia that are thought to be important in these cystic kidney diseases are the non-motile cilia that are involved in signaling. These are found in nearly all vertebrate cell types. They're thought to be important in the detection of extracellular signals such as photosensation, mechanosensation, osmolality sensation, thermal sensation, olfactory sensation, as well as hormone detection. And there are, for example, there are receptors for somatostatin that are localized to primary cilia. Are also thought to be important in signal transduction, and the signals they transduce are probably involved in things like cell proliferation, determination of planar cell polarity, cell differentiation, growth of nerves, as well as tissue maintenance. As far as the fibrocystin goes, or the primary cilium in the kidney, they're thought to act as a flow sensor in the kidney tubules. So there's a complex localized to the primary cilia of kidney cells that consists of polycystin 1 and polycystin 2, shown here and here. And these are the two proteins that are mutated in autosomal dominant polycystic kidney disease, as well as fibrocystin, shown here, which is the protein that's mutated in the autosomal recessive form. And it's thought that this complex acts as a mechanosensor to detect flow through the kidney tubules. So as flow, this is a renal cell with the primary cilium sticking up, and the polycystins and the fibrocystin are localized here. And as flow goes across this kidney, the surface of this kidney cell, it causes the cilium to bend. That results in an influx of calcium through this channel, which is the polycystin 2 protein. That results in release of calcium from intracellular stores, and that results in signal transduction within the kidney cells that are probably important in a variety of pathways, including proliferation, differentiation, cell polarity, as well as planar cell polarity. It's not clear what the mechanism of cyst formation is in these polycystic kidney diseases. There are some things that are known about the cystic phenotype. So, for example, as we talked about, there's abnormalities of primary cilia. It's thought that one mechanism may be altered planar cell polarity. And planar cell polarity is the way that epithelial cells, when they're in a sheet, they have to align themselves along some axis. So, for example, if this is a kidney tubule, all of the mitotic spindles in this of the cells that make this kidney tubule are aligned with the longitudinal axis of the tubule itself. So as these cells divide, you get primarily increase in the length of the tubule because of the way the mitotic spindles are aligned with each other. When if there's defects of primary cilia where this planar cell polarity is disrupted, you now have a kidney tubule where mitotic spindles are no longer necessarily aligned with the longitudinal axis of the tubule, but are randomized. So when these cells begin to divide, instead of getting longitudinal increase, you can get dilation of the nephron or the kidney tubules, and that can be the result in cyst formation later on as these tubules expand abnormally. And the Wnt signaling pathway has been shown to be involved in this determination of this polarity. It's thought that the primary cilium acts as a switch to go from canonical Wnt signaling to non-canonical Wnt signaling. And when that's disrupted, you lose this normal planar cell polarity. There's also been shown to be abnormalities of epidermal growth factor and epidermal growth factor expression. So the polarity of the cell is disrupted. So instead of having epidermal growth factor expressed in the apex of the cell, it's expressed in the basal region. And there are also seen to be abnormalities of cyclic AMP signaling and decreased intracellular calcium and increased cell proliferation associated with cyst formation. So just to summarize, I think these two patients, the baby girl S, who I talked about at the beginning with primary ciliary dyskinesia, and baby boy H with the autosomal recessive polycystic kidney disease, are really nice ways to illustrate the importance of cilia in normal cell function. I think we've gone, our understanding of cilia has really increased from the 17th century when it was just thought that they were motile structures to now they're, you know, we've understand something about the complexity of their assembly and structure. We understand that some of their function is motility, so they're required for moving fluids across epithelial surfaces as well as movement of things like sperm. But we've also more recently become to appreciate the importance of these primary cilia in detecting extracellular signals and signal transduction within a large variety of cells. It's clear that disrupting this assembly or function results in a wide variety of human diseases with many different phenotypes. And as I've shown, you know, that our understanding of the genetics of cilia assembly and function is rapidly increasing, so we're getting much better understanding of how cilia form and what genes to look at when we're looking for mutations that are involved associated with these diseases. Unfortunately, most of the current therapies we have for these diseases are supportive. Hopefully, as our understanding of these, the genetics of these diseases improves, we will be able to develop more directed therapies for the disease we see. I'd like to just quickly acknowledge people who were involved in the FOXJ1 work. I think the important person for you is Bridget Gompertz, who is now here at UCLA, but there are a lot of other people who did that, were involved in that work, and I'd like to take any questions. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.